but I was not raised with a fundamentalist background. In fact, it was a very loose Christian background, loose in that I wasn't accustomed to going to church an awful lot. When I married my husband, I joined his church, which was an Episcopal church. Again, it was a very loose relationship and remains that today. Somewhere along the line, I'd come to the conclusion that I certainly was at the point of being an agnostic, perhaps even an atheist. But I think because of my childhood habits, I didn't dare quite become a total atheist. Just in case. She laughed. I want you to know where I was coming from as I lay in the hospital the night before the surgery. I really was convinced I might not come out of this. I said what I thought might possibly be my last prayer. I whispered into what I would call the darkness, "I don't know if you're there, but if you are, this is the best I can do." And I tried to review everything, and to see if spiritually I had left anything undone. Then I said, "I don't really think you're there, but if you are, I really need some help." I went right to the wall. "I'm sorry, I can't have more faith, but in all honesty, this is the best, in the final analysis, that I can do. So anyhow, I came through the surgery fine, but I felt like hell because I hurt. I was hurting so bad, all I could think of was, when was the next shot? I'm putting this all in because I think I have to be honest. I was drifting in and out, and I was being given Demerol. So for the skeptics, they can say, well, she was on painkillers. It doesn't matter. The skeptics are going to say what they're going to say anyway. About the third day in intensive care, I fell asleep. And suddenly I was going down a very long, dark canyon. I felt very, very warm and very, very secure, but it was the blackest canyon I've ever seen. They were like mountain walls that seemed quite far away, and then suddenly they seemed close. At one point I looked on these mountain walls and instead of being all black, they almost appeared orange with dark, flickering lights against them. It had something to do with souls, but I don't remember what it was. But it was a very warm, secure feeling. As I was going down the canyon, I saw a very misty place just ahead of me. And as I came upon it, I could see that there was some kind of a rocks barrier blocking the entire entrance to this canyon. You couldn't go on, but there was just enough room to squeeze around it. There was mist everywhere. And then I saw the people standing there. There were two men, and another shadowy figure. All of a sudden, I recognized who that person was, and then he was no longer a shadowy figure. This is funny, but he looked like Gene Wilder used to look in Willy Wonka. He had that wonderful curly, curly hair and was wearing a suit with white piping. My first thought was, what is this? And then all of a sudden I realized I was dying. I did experience a moment of fear there. Then this man in this suit said, "You are at death." Those were the words, "You are at death." Then I realized that he was the angel of death. He didn't say it, but I knew it. And I thought to myself, he was a little intimidating. But when he said, "You are at death," it was so kind that I was not afraid. I was just not afraid at all. He was so kind. And he was so efficient. It was incredible. And I remember pondering it, then nodding my head and saying, "I know. Now I'm going to say all of the rest of this in a jumble," because I was getting information simultaneously. It was just coming in from impressions. Where someone said something, I will quote exactly what they said. My first thought was, there really is something after death. There really is. I was absolutely astounded. I kept saying, "But death is so easy. It's so easy. It's like getting up out of this chair and sitting down in that chair." These men were nodding their heads. And one of them said, "Yes, but it is hard to get there." I didn't understand it, but that's what he said. Then the man in the suit said, "And you are being given a choice." Now I thought of several things. One thought was, death is a dancer. That's a strange thought, but I'm trying to relate what I got at the time in its purest form. I got the impression at that point that I was not always going to be given a choice. I also got the impression that not everyone was given a choice. That this was just at this particular time, at this point. Then I also got the impression that this angel of death was not this being's permanent position. I felt that he was just on assignment, and that he wouldn't always be having this assignment. There were some other shadowy figures there, and I perceived that they were there to help me. Because he said, "Do you wish to stay or do you wish to go?" Now stay meant stay with them, go meant go back. It's not what you would normally think. It was the reverse. Do you wish to stay or do you wish to go? And I knew it was wonderful there, and I wanted to stay. Excited, and so I said, "I want to stay." I can't remember his exact words, but he said, "There are some things you have to know before you make up your mind." Then I was shown my mother and she was crying and sobbing. And he said, "Now your mother will be destroyed. And she, in her destruction, will destroy those around her." And I'm sure he was talking about my father. I perceived that her life would just be over at that point. And in his love for her, his life would be over. But I said, "Oh, I want to stay." Because I perceived that time was so fast there, that it was nothing. They would be there so quickly, and they would understand when they got there. I also perceived another thing, that whatever way I chose was just right. There was absolutely no judgment or censure, but what I chose to do was the right thing to do. Then I was shown my husband. He was crying and he was saying, "I never knew I loved her," which fits in with the way the marriage was at that time. I saw it would be very hard on him, but I said, "I want to stay." Because I knew that in just a little while everybody would be there, and they'd all understand. Then he said, "Now, your children will be all right, but they will not go as far as they could." But I still said, "I want to stay." I knew my children would be all right. Maybe not do as well as if I was there, but they'd still not go under. To stay there was still the most attractive choice. And then death said, "Now, you will have to stay close to your children." In other words, stay close to the edge. And I was told I would have to guide my children. I was just astonished, because that's not what I wanted. I wanted to go on over to this happy place and learn. I don't know how I knew I could learn there. It just came into my mind, and I knew. I hadn't seen it, but I knew the minute these people opened their mouths, that this was a place that I wanted to be. I just knew that there were answers there. The answers, I suppose. There were studies, answers, growth. This was just instinctive. But I knew it was a place I wanted to stay. I sure didn't want to leave it and go back to these problems. I wanted to be there. But I reluctantly said at that point, "Well, if I have to stay close to the edge, I might as well go back. I've got these responsibilities. And I can handle it better from that side than I can by just trying to stay close to my children and influencing." So I said, "Okay, I'll go." And they all seemed quite pleased that I had decided that, even though there would have been no censure or judgment. I felt as if I was beginning to pull back. And I saw those other minor figures whispering, "She's going to go. She's going to go." I can't remember if they disappeared or if they went around the barrier. I think they went around the barrier. And I perceived that they had been there to help me cross over. But they weren't needed, so they disappeared. Then I started to pull back, as if I was leaving. And one of these men spoke up and said, "Before you go, there are some things we want you to know." Instantly I was in another place. I wasn't in the tunnel anymore. It was kind of like a backyard, and there was a circle of people. I've tried since then to guess how many were in that circle of people sitting around in chairs. I would guess maybe 8-10 men and women. I perceived that they were my council. And I knew that every single person has a council that has a responsibility for each soul down here. They sort of reminded me of a country Sunday school group meeting out at the churchyard, maybe in the afternoon or something. I really couldn't see faces, but this one person sort of guided me. I remembered his bare arms and his rolled up white shirt sleeves, very much like men would do at a warm Sunday, summer, Bible class type of thing. He took me over to a girl sitting under a tree, and she had black skin, colored skin. And he kind of plucked at her skin. She made the motions of pinching the skin of her forearm between her thumb and forefinger, and he said, "This is so unimportant, Thiskin. This is so unimportant. It's just a little covering. It is so unimportant, it's laughable." And then they both kind of laughed. And I was thinking, why is he telling me this? I know that. Then the next picture was, we were standing on a road, and there was at least one of my counselors with me. These two young men of East Indian visage were walking up the road, and they were there to show me myself. Now I was standing there, and all of a sudden next to me was myself. I saw a beautiful, very large, brilliant, opaque shimmering sphere that I knew was myself. And I walked around, and I entered myself, this sphere of light. She illustrated with hand motions the act of entering the top of this sphere and proceeding downward through it to come out of the bottom, and I knew that when I came out I would have all my answers. I would know myself. And I did. But when I went into the sphere I descended. It was like being bathed in milky white, very comfortable. And I thought, any minute now I will reach the center. And soon I reached on through and emerged out the other side, sort of at a downward angle. I knew when I was in the center, but the center was exactly like the periphery. In other words, the center was exactly like the edges. Yet I perceived when I was in the edges and going through and in the center and coming out again. But the center was exactly like the periphery. They were just the same composition. When I came out I knew myself. And I stood there, and I felt embarrassed. I felt naked because I knew myself and I perceived my good and my bad, and I made no judgment upon myself. And I said, I've got to work on that. And they knew me, too. They knew me totally. And they smiled and nodded. And the nice thing was that there was no censure. Absolutely none. No judgment. This is where I get hazy. I cannot recall which came next. I looked up and the sky was suddenly darkened, and it was filled with stars. Some were huge and some were medium and some were tiny, and they were of varying brilliancies but not one outshone the other. Even if there was a very tiny one next to a huge, brilliant one, you could still see each with equal clarity. And I knew the stars were souls. I said, well, where's mine? And someone said, there it is. I looked behind me and there was my star. It had just risen off the horizon. And suddenly I was there, in the place where my star was. And I felt like I was interwoven into fabric. In that instant I knew that we were all totally connected and that no matter what happened we could not be destroyed. Even if something came and ripped the fabric would hold. I knew that I could not be destroyed, nor could anyone else. That I was as I was as I am. Then I was next back in the meadow, standing at that roadside. And I looked out across this beautiful sunlit meadow and there was a grove of trees. It was symbolic to me that there was a grove, but I perceived that within it was the tree of life. And suddenly, out of this grove of trees, came this enormous ball of lightning. I just watched it as it flew across the meadow. And it struck me right here. She put her hand on her chest over her heart area. It was as though I had the breath knocked out of me. It was as if every ounce of everything was sucked out of me and I was consumed. And what came into me was total, pure, unconditional love. It was so incredible. It went into every cell, and I could hardly get my breath. There wasn't anything I could give except love because that was all I was composed of. It had taken over every atom. And then I started coming back. And someone shouted to me, and it may have been my counselor, stay married. You're meant to be married. Resignedly, which I have done. I came back. And I woke up and I saw the nurse in the intensive care unit leaning over me with the most concerned look on her face. She was watching me. And I thought, don't worry, I'm all right. I'm not going to die. And I won't go away again. I also thought, oh, you don't know where I've been. I didn't tell anybody for quite a few days. Later we discussed the possibility that Meg was dying and maybe the nurse had either seen something on the machines or in the way she was acting. When Meg was zapped by the ball of lightning that might have been an actual jolt to the body to restore life, she returned to her body immediately after being jolted. It could have affected her rather like the electric shocks administered to a patient after their heart stops. There will undoubtedly be debate about whether this incident really occurred or whether it was a drug-related fantasy. But Meg has no such argument going on within her. She knows it was real. There is no doubt in her voice as she relates the incident. She knows because it changed her life forever. As Meg said, maybe someone has to almost lose their life in order to find it. I was to enter the fascinating spirit realm many times. This is the area that holds the most fear for humans, and the one that raises the eternal question, where will I go when I die? Everyone wonders what will happen to them, whether there will be total oblivion or continuation of the personality. Even the most religious still harbor their uncertainties. I do not have all the answers, but I believe I can help through the information I have received in my regression research. Even the regressed somnambulist cannot tell you what they do not know. But when you obtain the same descriptions from many different people, you have to assume it has validity. Maybe it rings true because the majority would truly like to believe the afterlife is a place of peace and contentment. I personally find the idea of staying in the ground until Resurrection Day or Judgment Day totally repulsive. Also, the idea of floating around on a cloud playing a harp for eternity is not my vision of heaven. I think it would get boring quickly. Maybe I find this concept of the schools attractive because of my insatiable curiosity and my constant quest for knowledge. Whatever the case, I think this gives us the best description and maybe, just maybe, the answers to some of the haunting questions that plague us all. Many times when I regressed different subjects, they would not be involved with a life. Their answers would reveal that they were in between, on various spirit levels or planes and in different places. The most common of these was the school. I asked for a description. 35s, it is the school of knowledge. I see the hall. It has tall pillars and it's all in white. Real light, how do I explain it? The light comes from within and without, from everything and just shines. D, do you mean like sunlight? S, not that bright, but more lasting. It's very peaceful, very restful, very calm. It is a very nice place to be. D, where is this school of knowledge? S, it's just here. It is on a different vibration from the existence known as Earth. It is on a separate plane of existence. D, it has no connection with Earth? S, we learn of what we have done, and in this way it has a connection with Earth, but none other than that. D, you said this is like a big hall. Are all the classes held in the hall? S, no, they have classrooms off of it. This is kind of a main walkway, I guess. You can see anything that you want to see here. Just by visualizing it, it occurs. You can make it as nice or as bad you wish. If you're dealing with a guilty conscience and want to make yourself suffer, you can make yourself do that also. You can make the surroundings look like you want them, or the way you have visualized it. On some planes, including the plane that I am on now, it's like being on a higher plane of Earth, so the topography here is similar, but it has a finer energy level. I mean, there are hills and mountains and valleys, but they may not be positioned exactly like the hills there on Earth. There's greenery and such, but the colors are more intense and purer. One can also have buildings and such here, but usually their constructs of energy are influenced in such a way as to give off a certain image. D, would the other people here see the same things you are seeing? S, yes. The mountains and greenery are general features of this plane that everyone sees. It's Earth, but it's at a different energy level. And with it being a different energy level, the laws governing energy are different. The ground is solid and the hills are solid, and the trees and the animals really exist, they're really there. It's like the plane of incarnation that I will be going to again. But since the laws of energy are different, other things can be done with artificial constructs. D. Does everybody have to manifest it or is it just there all the time? S, D, S, D, S, D, S, D, S, it's there all the time. It's just a matter of personal perception as to whether or not you perceive it. Do you mean there are people who might come there and not see the same things you see? No, I'm speaking of people on the plane of incarnation. They would not perceive it because they're perceiving things at a lower level or a lower plane. Would this place be equivalent to what some people call heaven apostrophe? No. It is probably what they would refer to as paradise. I'm making a distinction between heaven and paradise because paradise means a perfected earth. Sometimes earthly, but without the destruction and decay that exists on the plane of incarnation. And heaven refers to the higher planes of existence that the spirit knows of instinctively, although it cannot convey a clear picture of it with the inadequate vocabulary and concepts available on the plane of incarnation. Heaven refers to the higher planes, where everything is energy. And paradise refers to these so-called lower planes where it's still similar to Earth because you're on a higher plane of Earth. Then whenever somebody talks about going to heaven, they're going to a higher plane where there are no pictures, so to speak. It's all energy or other scenes around them? Well, it's mostly energy and energy manipulation. But when people speak of dying and going to heaven, what they actually do is go to paradise because everything must be taken in order, and things must be perceived and comprehended in order. You have to be prepared for higher levels so that you can assimilate them more fairly. But in the area known as heaven, would it just be all blank or would there be scenes, buildings or whatever? No, not buildings. Your perception is different and you can see the energies. It would be like fantastic displays of aurora borealis. You would be energy yourself and you could manipulate the energies to achieve different things and cause different things to happen. When you're in the higher planes referred to as heaven, you can look into the lower planes very easily and see the physical planes and see what's going on. It's no problem seeing things, it's just a matter of what level you're looking at as to what you see. But there would be no surroundings because there are no horizons. D. But you said people wouldn't go there right away. S. That is true. Usually when one dies there is a period of transition where one can adjust to the fact that one is no longer on the plane of incarnation. When one adjusts to that fact then one has the freedom to move between the planes that one has access to, according to how advanced your spirit is. D. Is there anyone else there with you at the school? S. There are about 50 people just in my class. There are others here, but we don't have much to do with them. They are working out other problems. They have different lessons that they have to learn, and they must come to terms with it within their own selves. I just consider that I'm waiting. I know I'm going back. I learn here and I can look at and evaluate the things that happened while on Earth because I'm not hampered with worldly influences. D. When you learn, do you do it all by yourself or does someone help you? S. No. I get help if I need it. If I search or if I ask or I question, all things come and it's there. D. Who is teaching you? S. The masters. Each class has several. They teach you to study oneself. D. How do the people look? I mean, do they have clothes? S. Here they wear robes, but not always. Basically the way we look over here is ectoplasm in its various forms. Sometimes you will see someone with the shape of a body and they'll appear to have clothing on, but they'll be rather white and transparent looking. Or sometimes if they wish to look more solid, they do. And whatever type of clothing they want to project as wearing, they'll do it as being part of the type of image they want to project at that particular time. D. Then all of them don't look alike. S. No. And even one particular one will not necessarily look alike from one time to the next. It depends on what they want to achieve. But at this time in this place they have robes. D. What are you learning at the school? S. I'm studying life experiences and effects. I study long and hard in order to learn and to know. I put the pieces of my D.S.D.S.D.S.D.S. experiences together and compile them to make sense of my existence. I ask myself, how do these things affect me? How did I handle them? It is very peaceful and quiet here, so I have much time to myself, solitude. I think and I work through these things. Sometimes I go back through experiences and try to understand. You see, in life I tilted my judgment to fit, for whatever reason usually it to make me feel justified in my actions. And here I can analyze, so I go through the situation again to get a truer perspective of what really happened. I try to understand why I acted and reacted in such a way so as not to repeat previous errors. We amass great knowledge here of lessons to be learned, karma to be dealt with. We learn many things about dealing with human nature and about the problems that I had to face. Also the problems I will be facing and the decisions to be made about that. And through this I will learn to grow and expand. Will you face these problems while you're there? No, the next time I'm born. I'm preparing to descend again. Did they tell you what kind of problems you will have to face? Some, but not a lot. We're just going over what I should decide and talking about work that I want to handle and what problems I want to deal with. You mean you're trying to figure out which ones you want to handle, or are there some you'll have to? Some that you'll have to. But right now it's really a learning situation. Do you think you will have many problems to face next time? Depending on what you call problems. Many of them are just decisions and how I will handle myself and relationships with other people. When you go through something on earth, be it good, be it bad, the important thing is your attitude. The way you accept it. How do you handle the defeats? How do you handle your victories? How do you deal with situations and problems? How do you accept failures? Are you gracious? You know, your life situations. All these are the sum total of who and what you are. And self-deception, that's a big one. People can't be honest and can't look at things. They make excuses for why they do things and justify it and twist it until they've lost all truth. D. Are there any particular lessons that you're having trouble with? S. I have to learn to speak up for myself. I have to learn to be more demanding and not let people manipulate me so much. Part of my problem is that I've been around so long and I'm always so aware that it's not that big a thing, that I sort of float through the situations. I've let people manipulate me because it really didn't make that much difference to me. So one have to be more decisive and learn to make decisions. I don't really like doing that. D. Do you draw these situations to you so you can work them out? Or do you plan that far in advance? S. I think you make many of the situations. Whatever is in your mind sometimes comes about. Your spirit knows what things you need to learn and then it creates situations without you really being aware of what's going on. But it all happens for reasons. When I'm there on earth I won't really know, I won't really decide. I'll just think they're happening by chance. But they've all been thought about and planned out for purposes. D. Does anybody help you make these plans? S. Yes, sometimes I let other people here help me. There's a woman who's helped me a lot. She looks after me. Sometimes even in a life I seem to become more aware of her existence. For instance, when I'm growing out of being a child. Sometimes when I'm very involved in everything I'm not as aware of her presence. Here she sometimes shows me how certain actions will affect me in a life. She'll flash them like on a movie screen on a wall. And she will say things like, this is what will happen if you do this. And this is the problem you will face, you know, she'll explain it where I wasn't aware of it. In life, there were difficulties when I knew something was wrong but couldn't see it. Sometimes she's made things that I needed to know knowledgeable to me. D. Do you know how long you're going to stay here? S. Not long. I know I need to get on with it. I want to learn all I can. I try to continue all of my learning as much as I possibly can. At times I think that I have pretty well got it and then there are always things that come up, something that I never quite thought of. Thoughtfully, you never completely get it, I guess. But you can perfect it and try it. It's like putting something in a furnace and refining it. D. Do you like experiencing Earth? S. Well, even though I think there's nothing more I can learn, each time I learn something else, I have a tendency to be a touch rebellious. I know that I've not overcome it yet, even though I like to think I have. D. Is it mandatory that you return to Earth and inhabit a body again or do you have a choice? S. No, for there is no have to. If it is most appropriate, yes, then that might be the best thing to do. However, there is no rule that says one has to incarnate, for who is to say that one might choose not to reincarnate forever? It is up to the life force involved. I can stay here and learn or I can go back. I will probably go back. I look at the piece and I think I'm ready for the challenges. D. Do you make any decision as to when you come back? S. When I find someone who I feel will fit my need, then I have a choice. You get involved with other people. You build ties and emotions. You are open, you feel, you sense, and their lives affect you. D. Is it all planned in advance? S. It has to be because there are so many who wish to return in so few bodies to return into. D. Do you make all these decisions yourself? S. No, ours are the lesser decisions to make. The teachers and the masters help us decide the major decisions and the major happenings. D. It sounds like it would be complicated. S. Yes, but it works.